This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Dark Places by Gillian Flynn. Read for you by Rebecca Lohman, Cassandra Campbell, Mark Deakins, and Robert Sandine. The Days were a clan that might have lived long, but Ben Day's head got screwed on wrong. That boy craved Dark Satan's power, so he killed his family in one nasty hour. Little Michelle he strangled in the night, then chopped up Debbie, a bloody sight. Mother Patty he saved for last, blew off her head with a shotgun blast. Baby Libby somehow survived, but to live through that ain't much a life. Schoolyard Rhyme, circa 1985. Libby Day, now. I have a meanness inside me, real as an organ. Slit me at my belly and it might slide out, meaty and dark, drop on the floor so you could stomp on it. It's the day blood. Something's wrong with it. I was never a good little girl, and I got worse after the murders. Little orphan Libby grew up sullen and boneless, shuffled around a group of lesser relatives, second cousins and great aunts and friends of friends, stuck in a series of mobile homes or rotting ranch houses all across Kansas. Me going to school in my dead sister's hand-me-downs, shirts with mustardy armpits, pants with baggy bottoms, comically loose, held on with a raggedy belt cinched to the farthest hole. In class photos, my hair was always crooked, barrettes hanging loosely from strands as if they were airborne objects caught in the tangles. And I always had bulging pockets under my eyes, drunk landlady eyes. Maybe a grudging curve of the lips where a smile should be. Maybe. I was not a lovable child, and I'd grown into a deeply unlovable adult. Draw a picture of my soul, and it'd be a scribble with fangs. It was miserable, wet bone March, and I was lying in bed thinking about killing myself, a hobby of mine. Indulgent afternoon daydreaming, a shotgun, my mouth, a bang and my head jerking once, twice, blood on the wall. Splatter, splatter. Did she want to be buried or cremated? People would ask. Who should come to the funeral? And no one would know. The people, whoever they were, would just look at each other's shoes or shoulders until the silence settled in, and then someone would put on a pot of coffee, briskly and with a fair amount of clatter. Coffee goes great with sudden death. I pushed a foot out from under my sheets, but couldn't bring myself to connect it to the floor. I am, I guess, depressed. I guess I've been depressed for about 24 years. I can feel a better version of me somewhere in there, hidden behind a liver or attached to a bit of spleen within my stunted, childish body. A Libby that's telling me to get up, do something, grow up, move on. But the meanness usually wins out. My brother slaughtered my family when I was 7. My mom, 2 sisters, gone. Bang, bang, chop, chop, choke, choke. I didn't really have to do anything after that. Nothing was expected. I inherited $321,374 when I turned 18, the result of all those well-wishers who'd read about my sad story, do-gooders whose hearts had gone out to me. Whenever I hear that phrase, and I hear it a lot, I picture juicy doodle hearts complete with bird wings, flapping toward one of my many crap-ass childhood homes, my little girl self at the window, waving and grabbing each bright heart, green cash sprinkling down on me. Thanks! Thanks a ton! When I was still a kid, the donations were placed in a conservatively managed bank account, which, back in the day, saw a jump about every 3 to 4 years, when some magazine or news station ran an update on me. Little Libby's brand new day. The lone survivor of the Prairie Massacre turns a bittersweet 10. Me in scruffy pigtails on the possum-pissed lawn outside my Aunt Diane's trailer. Diane's thick tree calves exposed by a rare skirt planted in the yellow grass behind me. Brave baby days, sweet 16! Me, still miniature, my face aglow with birthday candles, my shirt too tight over breasts that had gone D-cup that year, comic book-sized on my tiny frame. Ridiculous. Porny. I'd lived off that cash for more than 13 years, but it was almost gone. I had a meeting that afternoon to determine exactly how gone. Once a year, the man who managed the money, an unblinking, pink-cheeked banker named Jim Jeffries, insisted on taking me to lunch. A checkup, he called it. We'd eat something in the $20 range and talk about my life. He'd known me since I was this high, after all. As for me, I knew almost nothing about Jim Jeffries, and never asked, viewing the appointments always from the same kid's eye view. Be polite, but barely, and get it over with. Single word answers, tired sighs. The one thing I suspected about Jim Jeffries was that he must be Christian, churchy. He had the patience and optimism of someone who thought Jesus was watching. I wasn't due for a checkup for another 8 or 9 months, but Jim Jeffries had nagged, leaving phone messages in a serious, hushed voice, saying he'd done all he could to extend the life of the fund, but it was time to think about next steps. And here again came the meanness. I immediately thought about that other little tabloid girl, Jamie something, who'd lost her family the same year, 1985. She'd had part of her face burned off in a fire her dad set that killed everyone else in her family. Anytime I hit the ATM, I think of that Jamie girl, and how if she hadn't stolen my thunder, I'd have twice as much money. That Jamie whatever was out at some mall with my cash, buying fancy handbags and jewelry and buttery department store makeup to smooth onto her shiny, scarred face. Which was a horrible thing to think, of course. I at least knew that. Finally, 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 I pulled myself out of bed with a stage effect groan and wandered to the front of my house. I rent a small brick bungalow within a loop of other small brick bungalows, all of which squat on a massive bluff overlooking the former stockyards of Kansas City. Kansas City, Missouri, not Kansas City, Kansas. There's a difference. My neighborhood doesn't even have a name. It's so forgotten. It's called Over There That Way, a weird subprime area full of dead ends and dog crap. The other bungalows are packed with old people who've lived in them since they were built. The old people sit, gray and pudding-like, behind screen windows, peering out at all hours. Sometimes they walk to their cars on careful, elderly tiptoes that make me feel guilty, like I should go help. But they wouldn't like that. They are not friendly old people. They are tight-lipped, pissed-off old people who do not appreciate me being their neighbor, this new person. The whole area hums with their disapproval. So there's the noise of their disdain, and there's the skinny red dog 2 doors down who barks all day and howls all night. The constant background noise you don't realize is driving you crazy until it stops. Just a few blessed moments, and then starts up again. The neighborhood's only cheerful sound I usually sleep through. The morning coos of toddlers. A troop of them, round-faced and multi-layered, walk to some daycare, hidden even farther in the rat's nest of streets behind me, each clutching a section of a long piece of rope trailed by a grown-up. They march, penguin-style, past my house every morning, but I have not once seen them return. For all I know, they trottle around the entire world and return in time to pass my window again in the morning. Whatever the story, I'm attached to them. There are 3 girls and a boy, all with a fondness for bright red jackets. And when I don't see them, when I oversleep, I actually feel blue. Bluer. That'd be the word my mom would use, not something as dramatic as depressed. I've had the blues for 24 years. I put on a skirt and blouse for the meeting, feeling dwarfy, my grown-up, big-girl clothes never quite fitting. I'm barely 5 foot, 4 foot 10 inches in truth, but I round up. Sue me. I'm 31, but people tend to talk to me in sing-song, like they want to give me finger paints. I headed down my weedy front slope, the neighbor's red dog launching into its busy-bodied barking. On the pavement near my car are the smashed skeletons of 2 baby birds, their flattened beaks and wings making them look reptilian. They've been there for a year. I can't resist looking at them each time I get in my car. We need a good flood. Wash them away. 2 elderly women were talking on the front steps of a house across the street, and I could feel them refusing to see me. I don't know anyone's name. If one of those women died, I couldn't even say, "Poor old Mrs. Zielinski died." I'd have to say, "That mean old bitch across the street bit it." Feeling like a child ghost, I climbed into my anonymous mid-sized car, which seems to be made mostly of plastic. I keep waiting for someone from the dealership to show up and tell me the obvious. "It's a joke. You can't actually drive this. We were kidding." I transdrove my toy car 10 minutes downtown to meet Jim Jeffries, rolling into the steakhouse parking lot 20 minutes late, knowing he'd smile all kindly and say nothing about my tardiness. I was supposed to call him from my cell phone when I arrived so he could trot out and escort me in. The restaurant, a great old-school KC steakhouse, is surrounded by hollowed-out buildings that concern him, as if a troop of rapists was permanently crouched in their empty husks awaiting my arrival. Jim Jeffries is not going to be the guy who let something bad happen to Libby Day. Nothing bad can happen to brave baby Day, little girl lost. The pathetic red-headed 7-year-old with big blue eyes. The only one who survived the Prairie Massacre, the Kansas Craze killings, the farmhouse Satan sacrifice. My mom, 2 older sisters, all butchered by Ben. The only one left, I'd fingered him as the murderer. I was the cutie pie who brought my devil-worshipping brother to justice. I was big news. The Inquirer put my tearful photo on the front page with the headline, "Angel Face." I peered into the rearview mirror and could see my baby face even now. My freckles were faded and my teeth straightened, but my nose was still pug and my eyes kitten round. I dyed my hair now, a white blonde, but the red roots had grown in. It looked like my scalp was bleeding, especially in the late-day sunlight. It looked gory. I lit a cigarette. I'd go for months without smoking. And then remember, I need a cigarette. I'm like that. Nothing sticks. "Let's go, baby day," I said aloud. It's what I call myself when I'm feeling hateful. I got out of the car and smoked my way toward the restaurant, holding the cigarette in my right hand so I didn't have to look at the left hand, the mangled one. It was almost evening. Migrant clouds floated in packs across the sky like buffalo, and the sun was just low enough to spray everything pink. Toward the river, between the looping highway ramps, obsolete grain elevators sat vacant, dusk black and pointless. I walked across the parking lot all by myself, atop a constellation of crushed glass. I was not attacked. It was, after all, just past 5 p.m. Jim Jeffries was an early bird eater, proud of it. He was sitting at the bar when I walked in, sipping a pop, and the first thing he did, as I knew he would, was grab his cell phone from his jacket pocket and stare at it as if it had betrayed him. "Did you call?" He frowned. "No, I forgot," I lied. He smiled then. "Well, anyway, I'm glad you're here, sweetheart. Ready to talk turkey?" He slapped $2 on the bar top and maneuvered us over to a red leather booth, sprouting yellow stuffing from its cracks. The broken slits scraped the backs of my legs as I slid in. A woof of cigarette stink burped out of the cushions. Jim Jeffries never drank liquor in front of me and never asked me if I wanted a drink, but when the waiter came, I ordered a glass of red wine and watched him try not to look surprised or disappointed or anything but Jim Jeffries-like. "What kind of red?" the waiter asked, and I had no idea, really. I never could remember the names of reds or whites or which part of the name you were supposed to say out loud, so I just said, "House." He ordered a steak, I ordered a double-stuffed baked potato, and then the waiter left, and Jim Jeffries let out a long, dentist-y sigh and said, "Well, Libby, we are entering a very new and different stage here together." "So how much is left?" I asked, thinking, say 10,000. "Do you read those reports I send you?" "I sometimes do," I lied again. I liked getting mail, but not reading it. The reports were probably in a pile somewhere in my house. "Have you listened to my messages?" "I think your cell phone is messed up. It cuts out a lot." I'd listened just long enough to know I was in trouble. I usually tuned out after Jim Jeffries' first sentence, which always began, "Your friend Jim Jeffries here, Libby." Jim Jeffries steepled his fingers and stuck his bottom lip out. "There is $982.12 left in the fund. As I've mentioned before, had you been able to replenish it with any kind of regular work, we'd have been able to keep it afloat, but..." He tossed out his hands and grimaced. "Things didn't work out that way." "What about the book? Didn't the book..." "I'm sorry, Libby. The book did not. I tell you this every year. It's not your fault, but the book..." "No. Nothing." Years ago, to exploit my 25th birthday, a publisher of self-help books asked me to write about how I'd conquered the ghosts of my past. I had in no way conquered much of anything, but I agreed to the book anyway, talking over the phone with a woman in New Jersey who did the actual writing. The book came out at Christmas time, 2002, with a cover photo of me sporting an unfortunate shag haircut. It was called Brand New Day. Don't just survive childhood trauma, surpass it. And it included a few childhood snapshots of me and my dead family, packed between 200 pages of gloppy, positive-thinking porridge. I was paid $8,000, and a smattering of survivors' groups invited me to speak. I flew to Toledo for a meeting of men who'd been orphaned young, to Tulsa for a special gathering of teenagers whose moms had been killed by their dads. I signed my book for mouth-breathing kids who asked me jarring questions, like, "Did my mom cook pies?" I signed the book for gray, needful old men peering at me from behind bifocals, their breath blasting burnt coffee and stomach acid. "Start a new day," I'd write, or "A new day awaits." How lucky to have a pun for a last name. The people who came to meet me always looked exhausted and desperate, standing uncertainly near me in loose packs. The groups were always small. Once I realized I wasn't getting paid for any of this, I refused to go anywhere. The book had already bombed anyway. "It seems like it should have made more money," I mumbled. I really wanted the book to make money in an obsessive, childish way. That feeling that if I wanted it enough, it should happen. It should happen. "I know," Jim Jeffries said, having nothing more to say on the subject after 6 years. He watched me drink my wine in silence.
But in a way, Libby, this presents you with a really interesting new phase of your life. I mean, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I could tell this was supposed to be charming, but it brought a burst of rage up in me. I didn't want to be anything. That was the fucking point. There's no money left? Jim Jeffries shook his head sadly and started salting his newly arrived steak, the blood pooling around it like bright Kool-Aid.
What about new donations? The 25th anniversary's coming up.
I felt another splash of anger for him making me say this aloud. Ben started his killing spree around 2 a.m. on January 3, 1985. The timestamp on my family's massacre, and here I was looking forward to it. Who said things like that? Why couldn't there have been even $5,000 left?
He shook his head again. There's no more, Libby. You're what, 30? A woman. People have moved on. They want to help other little girls, not me.
I'm afraid not.
People have moved on?
Really?
I felt a lurch of abandonment, the way I always felt as a kid when some aunt or cousin was dropping me off at some other aunt or cousin's house. I'm done, you take her for a while. And the new aunt or cousin would be real nice for about a week, try real hard with bitter little me, and then, in truth, it was usually my fault. It really was. That's not victim talk. I doused one cousin's living room with Aquanet and set fire to it. My Aunt Diane, my guardian, my mom's sister, my beloved, took me in and sent me away half a dozen times before she finally closed the door for good. I did very bad things to that woman.
There is always a new murder, I'm afraid, Libby. Jim Jeffries was droning. People have short attention spans. I mean, think how crazy people are going about Lizette Stevens.
Lizette Stevens was a pretty 25-year-old brunette who'd disappeared on the way home from her family's Thanksgiving dinner. All of Kansas City was invested in finding her. You couldn't turn on the news without seeing her photo smiling at you. The story had gone national in early February. Nothing at all had happened in the case for a month. Lizette Stevens was dead, and everyone knew that by now. But no one wanted to be the first to leave the party.
But, continued Jim Jeffries, I think everyone would like to hear you're doing well.
Awesome.
What about college?
He chewed off a hunk of meat. No.
What about we try to set you up in some sort of office job, filing and whatnot?
No. I folded in on myself, ignoring my meal, projecting glumness. That was another of my mom's words, glum. It meant having the blues in a way that annoyed other people, having the blues aggressively.
Well, why don't you take a week and do some thinking on it?
He was devouring his steak, his fork moving up and down briskly. Jim Jeffries wanted to leave. Jim Jeffries was done here. He left me with three pieces of mail and a grin that was supposed to be optimistic. Three pieces, all looking like junk. Jim Jeffries used to hand me bulging shoeboxes full of mail, most of them letters with checks inside. I'd sign the check over to him, and then the donor would receive a form letter in my blocky handwriting.
Thank you for your donation. It is people like you who let me look forward to a brighter future. Your truly, Libby Day.
It really did say, "Your truly," a misspelling that Jim Jeffries thought people would find poignant. But the shoeboxes of donations were gone, and I was left with a mere three letters and the rest of the night to kill. I headed back home, several cars blinking their headlights at me until I realized I was driving dark.
Kansas City's skyline glimmered to the east, a modest, mid-rise monopoly scatter, radio towers spiking here and there. I tried to picture things I could do for money, things that grown-ups did. I imagined myself in a nurse's cap, holding a thermometer, then in a snug blue cop's uniform, escorting a child across the street, then wearing pearls and a floral apron, getting dinner ready for my hubby. That's how screwed up you are, I thought. Your idea of adulthood still comes from picture books. And even as I was thinking it, I saw myself writing ABCs on a chalkboard in front of bright-eyed first graders. I tried to come up with realistic occupations, something with computers. Data entry, wasn't that some sort of job? Customer service, maybe? I'd seen a movie once where a woman walked dogs for a living, dressed in overalls and sweater sets and always holding flowers, the dogs slobbery and loving. I didn't like dogs, though. They scared me. I finally thought, of course, about farming. Our family had been farmers for a century, right down to my mom, until Ben killed her off. Then the farm got sold. I wouldn't know how to farm anyway. I have memories of the place. Ben mucking through the cold spring mud, swatting calves out of his way. My mom's rough hands digging into the cherry-colored pellets that would blossom into Milo. The squeals of Michelle and Debbie jumping on hay bales in the barn. It itches! Debbie would always complain, and then jump in again. I can never dwell in these thoughts. I've labeled the memories as if they were a particularly dangerous region. Dark place. Linger too long in an image of my mom trying to jury-rig the blasted coffee maker again, or of Michelle dancing around in her jersey nightgown, tube socks pulled up to her knees, and my mind would jerk into dark place. Maniacal smears of bright red sound in the night. That inevitable, rhythmic axe, moving as mechanically as if it were chopping wood. Shotgun blasts in a small hallway. The panicked, jaybird cries of my mother, still trying to save her kids with half her head gone. What does an administrative assistant do? I wondered. I pulled up to my house, stepped onto a slab of sidewalk where someone had scraped Jimmy Loves Tina in the concrete decades ago. Sometimes I had flashes of how the couple turned out. He was a minor league baseball player. She was a housewife in Pittsburgh, battling cancer. He was a divorced fireman. She was a lawyer who drowned off the Gulf Coast last year. She was a teacher. He dropped dead of an aneurysm at 20. It was a good, if gruesome, mind game. I had a habit of killing off at least one of them. I looked up at my rented house, wondered if the roof was lopsided. If the whole thing crashed in, I wouldn't lose much. I owned nothing of value but a very old cat named Buck, who tolerated me. As I hit the soggy, bowed steps, his resentful mews reached me from inside the house, and I realized I hadn't fed him today. I opened the door, and the ancient cat moved toward me, slow and crimped, like a jalopy with a busted wheel. I didn't have any cat food left. That had been on the to-do list for a week, so I went to the fridge, pulled out some slices of hardened Swiss cheese, and gave those to him. Then I sat down to open my 3 envelopes, my fingers smelling like sour milk. I never made it past the first letter. Dear Ms. Day, I hope this letter reaches you, as you seem to have no website. I have read about you and followed your story closely over the years, and I'm very interested to hear how you are doing and what you are up to these days. Do you ever do appearances? I belong to a group that would pay you $500 just to show up. Please contact me, and I will happily give you more information. Warmly, Lyle Worth. P.S. This is a legitimate business offer.
Stripping? Porn? Back when the book came out, with its section of Baby Day Grows Up photos, the most notable was me at 17, my wobbly woman breasts barely held in by a white trash halter top. I'd received several propositions from fringe nudie mags as a result, none of them offering enough money to make me think hard. Even now, 500 wouldn't quite do it if these guys did want me to get naked. But maybe, think positive, Baby Day. Maybe it really was a legit offer. Another of those mourners groups needing me to show up so they had a reason to talk about themselves. 500 for a few hours of sympathy was a doable exchange. The letter was typed, except for a phone number that had been inked at the bottom in assertive script. I dialed the number, hoping for voicemail. Instead, a cavernous pause came on the line, a phone picked up but not spoken into. I felt awkward, as if I'd called someone in the middle of a party I wasn't supposed to know about. 3 seconds, then a male voice. Hello? Hi, is this Lyle Wirth? Buck was nosing around my legs, anxious for more food. Who's this? Still in the background, a big, loud nothing, like he was at the bottom of a pit. This is Libby Day. You wrote me? Oh, holy cow. Really? Libby Day. Where are you? Are you in town? Which town? The man, or boy, he sounded young, yelled something at someone back behind him that included the phrase, I already did them, and then groaned into my ear. You in Kansas City? You live in Kansas City, right, Libby? I was about to hang up, but the guy started yelling, Hello! Hello! Into the line like I was some dazed kid not paying attention in class. So I told him I did live in Kansas City, and what did he want? He gave me one of those laughs, those you-won't-believe-this-but-laughs. Well, like I said, I wanted to talk to you about an appearance, maybe. Doing what? Well, I'm in a special club. There's a special club meeting here next week, and...
What kind of club?
Well, it's kind of different. It's sort of an underground thing. I said nothing. Let him twist. After the initial bravura, I could feel him get uneasy.
Good.
Oh, crap. It's impossible to explain over the phone. Can I, buy you a coffee?
It's too late for coffee, I said, and then realized he probably didn't even mean tonight. Probably meant sometime this week, and then I wondered again how I'd kill the next 4 or 5 hours.
Beer? Wine? He asked.
When?
Pause. Tonight? Pause.
Fine. Lyle Wirth looked like a serial killer, which meant he probably wasn't one. If you were chopping up hookers or eating runaways, you'd try to look normal. He was sitting at a grimy card table in the middle of Tim Clark's Grill, a humid dive attached to a flea market. Tim Clark's had become famed for its barbecue and was now being gentrified, an uneasy mix of grizzled old-timers and flop-haired dudes in skinny jeans. Lyle was neither. He was somewhere in his very early 20s, with wavy, mousy hair he'd tried to tame with too much gel in all the wrong places, so that it was half fuzzy, half shiny points. He wore wireless glasses, a tight members-only windbreaker, and jeans that were skinny, but not in a cool way, just in a tight way. He had features that were too delicate to be attractive on a man. Men shouldn't have rosebud lips. He caught my eye as I walked toward him. He wasn't recognizing me at first, just assessing me, this lady stranger. When I'd almost reached the table, it clicked for him. The freckles, the baby bird skeleton,
the pug nose that got pugger the longer someone held eye contact.
"Libby,"
he started, realized it was too familiar, and added,
"Day."
He stood up, pulled out one of the folding chairs, looked like he regretted the chivalry, and sat back down.
"Your hair's blonde."
"Yep," I said. I hate people who start conversations with facts. What are you supposed to do with that?
"Sure is hot today."
"Yes, it is." I peered around to signal for a drink. A mini-skirted waitress with voluptuous black hair had her pretty backside to us. I table-tapped my fingers till she turned around, gave me a face that had to have been at least 70 years old, her pancake makeup pooling in the crepe of her cheeks, purple veins marbling her hands. Some part of her creaked as she bent down for my order, snuffing when I asked for just a PBR.
"The brisket is really good here," Lyle said,
but he wasn't having it either, just sipping on the dregs of something milky. I don't eat meat, really, not since seeing my family sliced open. I was still trying to get Jim Jeffries and his sinewy steak out of my head. I shrugged no, waited for my beer, looking around like a tourist. Lyle's fingernails were dirty, first thing I noticed. The old waitress's black wig was ajar, strands of sweaty white hair stuck to her neck. She tucked a few back under as she grabbed a packet of fries, sizzling beneath the heat lamp. A fat man sat by himself at the next table, eating short ribs and examining his flea market purchase. A kitschy old vase with a mermaid on it. His fingers left grease marks on the mermaid's breasts. The waitress said nothing as she set the beer squarely in front of me and then purred over to the fat man, calling him honey. "So what's with the club?" I prompted. Lyle turned pink, his knee jittery beneath the table.
"Well, you know how some guys do fantasy football or collect baseball cards?"
I nodded. He let out a strange laugh and continued,
"Or women read gossip magazines and they know everything about some actor, know, like, their baby's name and the town they grew up in."
I gave a wary incline of the head, a be careful nod.
"Well, this is like that, but it's, well, we call it a kill club."
I took a slug of beer, sweat beads popping on my nose.
"It's not as weird as it sounds."
"It sounds pretty fucking weird.
You know how some people like mysteries? Or get totally into true crime blogs? Well, this club is a bunch of those people. Everyone has their crime that they're obsessed with. Lacey Peterson, Jeffrey McDonald, Lizzie Borden, you and your family. I mean, you and your family. It's huge with the club. Just huge. Bigger than JonBenet."
He caught me grimacing and added, "Just a tragedy. What happened?
And your brother in jail for what, going on 25 years?
"Don't feel sorry for Ben. He killed my family."
"Right."
He sucked on a piece of milky ice.
"So you ever talk with him about it?"
I felt my defenses flip up. There are people out there who swear Ben is innocent. They mail me newspaper clippings about Ben, and I never read them. Toss them as soon as I see his photo. His red hair loose and shoulder length and a Jesus cut to match his glowing, full of peace face. Pushing 40. I've never gone to see my brother in jail. Not in all these years. His current prison is, conveniently, on the outskirts of our hometown, Kanicki, Kansas, where he'd committed the murders to begin with. But I'm not nostalgic. Most of Ben's devotees are women. Jug-eared and long-toothed, permed and pantsuited, tight-lipped and crucifixed. They show up occasionally on my doorstep with too much shine in their eyes. Tell me that my testimony was wrong. I'd been confused, been coerced, sold a lie when I swore at age 7 that my brother had been the killer. They often scream at me. And they always have plenty of saliva. Several have actually slapped me. This makes them even less convincing.
A red-faced, hysterical woman is very easy to disregard, and I'm always looking for a reason to disregard. If they were nicer to me, they might have got me. No, I don't talk to Ben. If that's what this is about, I'm not interested. No, it's not. You'd just come to... It's like a convention almost, and you'd let us pick your brain. You really don't think about that night?
Dark place.
No, I don't. You might learn something interesting. There are some fans, experts, who know more than the detectives on the case. Not that that's hard. So these are a bunch of people who want to convince me Ben's innocent? Well, maybe.
Maybe you will convince them otherwise.
I caught a whiff of condescension. He was leaning in, his shoulders tense, excited.
I want $1,000. I could give you 700.
I glanced around the room again, noncommittal. I'd take whatever Lyle Worth gave me, because otherwise I was looking at a real job real soon, and I wasn't up for that. I'm not someone who can be depended on 5 days a week. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I don't even get out of bed 5 days in a row. I often don't remember to eat 5 days in a row. Reporting to a workplace where I would need to stay for 8 hours? 8 big hours outside my home? Was unfeasible.
700's fine, then, I said.
Excellent. And there'll be a lot of collectors there, so bring any souvenirs, items from your childhood you might want to sell. You could leave with $2,000 easy. Letters especially. The more personal, the better, obviously. Anything dated near the murders? January 3rd, 1985?
He recited it as if he'd said it often.
Anything from your mom. People are really fascinated by your mom.
People always were. They always wanted to know, what kind of woman gets slaughtered by her own son?
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 8:02 a.m. He was talking on the phone again. She could hear the cartoonish wah-wah-wah of his voice murmuring behind his door. He'd wanted an extension of his own. Half his schoolmates, he swore, had their own listings in the phone book. They were called children's lines. She'd laughed and then got pissed, because he got pissed at her for laughing. Seriously? A children's phone line? How spoiled were these kids? Neither of them mentioned it again. They were both easily embarrassed. And then, a few weeks later, he just come home, head tucked down, and showed her the contents of a shopping bag, a line splitter that would allow two phones to use the same extension, and a remarkably light plastic phone that didn't seem much different from the pink toy versions the girls used to play secretary. "Mr. Benjamin Day's office," they'd answer, trying to pull their older brother into the game. Ben used to smile and tell them to take a message. Lately, he just ignored them. Since Ben brought home his goodies, the phrase, "God dang phone cord," had been introduced to the Day home. The cord corkscrewed from the kitchen outlet, over the counter, down the hall, and crimped under the crack of his door, which was always closed. Someone tripped on the cord at least once a day, and this would be followed by a scream, if it was one of the girls, or a curse, if it was Patty or Ben. She'd asked him repeatedly to secure the cord against the wall, and he'd just as repeatedly failed to do it. She tried to tell herself this was normal teenage stubbornness, but for Ben it was aggressive, and it made her worry he was angry, or lazy, or something worse she hadn't even thought of. And who was he talking to? Before the mysterious addition of the second phone, Ben hardly ever got calls. He had two good friends, the Mueller brothers, overalled future farmers of America, who were so reticent they sometimes just hung up when she answered. and then Patty would tell Ben that Jim or Ed just called. But there had never been long conversations behind closed doors until now. Patty suspected her son finally had a girlfriend. But her few hints in that direction made Ben so uncomfortable. His pale skin turned blue-white, and his amber freckles actually glowed, like a warning. She'd backed off completely. She wasn't the kind of mother to jam open her kids' lives too wide. It was hard enough for a 15-year-old boy to get privacy in a house full of women. He'd installed a padlock on his door after he'd returned home from school one day to find Michelle squirreling through his desk drawers. The lock installation, too, was presented as a done deal. A hammer, some banging, and there it suddenly was. His own boy nest, secured. Again, she couldn't blame him. The farmhouse had gone girly in the years since Runner left. The curtains, the couches, even the candles were all apricot and lace. Little pink shoes and flowered undies and barrettes cluttered drawers and closets. Ben's few small assertions, the curlicue phone cord and the metallic manly lock, seemed understandable, actually. She heard a shot of laughter coming from behind his door, and it unnerved her. Ben wasn't a laugher, not even as a kid. At age 8, he'd looked at one of his sisters coolly and announced, "Michelle has a case of the giggles," as if it was something to be fixed. Patty described him as stoic, but his self-containment went beyond that. His dad certainly didn't know what to do with him, alternating between roughhousing, Ben stiff and unresponsive, as Runner crocodile rolled him on the floor, and recrimination, Runner complaining loudly that the kid was no fun, weird, girlish. Patty hadn't fared much better. She'd recently bought a book about mothering a teenage boy, which she'd hidden under her bed like pornography. The author said to be brave, ask questions, demand answers from your child. But Patty couldn't. Much more than a graze of a question pissed Ben off these days, triggered that unbearably loud silence from him. The more she tried to figure him out, the more he hid. In his room, talking to people she didn't know. Her three daughters were already awake, too. Had been for hours. A farm, even their pathetic, over-leveraged, undervalued one, demanded early rising, and the routine stuck through the winter. They were now fluffing around in the snow. She'd shooed them out like a pack of puppies so they wouldn't wake up Ben, then got annoyed when she heard his voice on the phone, realized he was already up. She knew that was the reason she was fixing pancakes, the girls' favorite. Even the score. Ben and the girls were always accusing her of taking sides, Ben forever being asked to have patience with the small ribboned creatures, the girls forever being begged to hush now, don't bother your brother. Michelle, at 10, was the oldest daughter. Debbie was 9, and Libby, 7. Jesus, Mom. It's like you dropped a litter, she could hear Ben admonish. She peeked out a filmy curtain to view the girls in their natural animal state. Michelle and Debbie, boss and assistant, constructing a snow fort from plans they hadn't bothered to share with Libby. Libby trying to nose into the side of the action, offering snowballs and rocks, and a long, waggly stick, each rejected with barely a glance. Finally, Libby bent at the legs for a good scream, then kicked the whole thing down. Patty turned away. Fists and tears were next, and she wasn't in the mood. Ben's door creaked open, and his heavy thumps at the end of the hall told her he was wearing those big black boots she hated. "Don't even look at them," she told herself. She said the same thing whenever he wore his camo pants. Dad wore camo pants. He sulked when she'd complained. Hunting. He wore them hunting, she'd corrected. She missed the kid who used to demand unflashy clothes, who wore only jeans and plaid button-downs, the boy with dark red curls and an obsession with airplanes. Here he came now, in black denim jacket, black jeans, and a thermal hat pulled down low. He mumbled something and aimed for the door. "Not before breakfast," she called. He checked, turned only his profile to her. "I gotta get a few things done." "That's fine. Have some breakfast with us." "I hate pancakes. You know that." "Damn it." "I'll make you something else. Sit." He wouldn't defy a direct order, would he? They stared each other down, Patty about to give in, when Ben sighed pointedly, then slumped onto a chair. He started fiddling with the salt shaker, pouring the granules on the table and plowing them into a pile. She almost told him not to do it, but stopped. It was enough for now that he was at the table. "Who were you talking to?" she asked, pouring him some orange juice she knew he'd leave untouched to spite her.
"Just some people."
"People? Plural?" He only raised his eyebrows. The screen door scissored open, and then the front door banged against the wall, and she could hear a series of boots tumbling onto the floor mat. Well-trained, untracking daughters that they were. The fight must have been settled quickly. Michelle and Debbie were already bickering about some cartoon on TV. Libby just marched right in and hurled herself on a chair next to Ben, shook some ice off her hair. Of Patty's three daughters, only Libby knew how to disarm Ben. She smiled up at him, gave a quick wave, and then stared straight ahead.
"Hey, Libby," he said, still sifting salt.
"Hey, Ben. I like your salt mountain."
"Thanks."
Patty could see Ben visibly reshell himself when the other two entered the kitchen, their bright, harsh voices splattering the corners of the room.
"Mom, Ben's making a mess," Michelle called out.
"It's fine, sweetie. Pancakes are almost ready. Ben, eggs?"
"Why does Ben get eggs?"
Michelle whined.
"Ben, eggs?"
"Yeah."
"I want eggs," Debbie said.
"You don't even like eggs,"
Libby snapped. She could always be depended on to side with her brother.
"Ben needs eggs 'cause he's a boy, a man."
That made Ben smile the slightest bit, which made Patty select the most perfectly round pancake for Libby. She piled the cakes onto the plates while the eggs spat at her, the fine calibrations of breakfast for five going surprisingly well. It was the last of the decent food, left over from Christmas. But she wouldn't worry right now. After breakfast, she'd worry.
"Mom, Debbie has her elbows on the table,"
Michelle in her bossy mode.
"Mom, Libby didn't wash her hands,"
Michelle again.
"Neither did you, Debbie."
"Nobody did,"
Libby, laughing.
"Dirty bugger,"
Ben said, and poked her in her side. It was some old joke with them, that phrase. Patty didn't know how it had started. Libby tilted her head back and laughed harder, a stage laugh designed to please Ben.
"Mother hugger,"
Libby giggled wetly, some sort of response. Patty soaped up a rag and passed it around to each so they could all stay seated at the table. Ben bothering to tease one of his sisters was a rare event, and it seemed like she could hold on to the good mood if everyone just stayed in their place. She needed the good mood. The way you need sleep after an all-nighter. The way you daydream of throwing yourself into bed. Every day she woke up and swore she wouldn't let the farm weigh her down. Wouldn't let the ruination of it. 3 years she was behind in the loan. 3 years, and no way out. Turn her into the kind of woman she hated. Mirthless, pinched, unable to enjoy anything. Every morning she'd crick herself down onto the flimsy rug by her bed and pray. But it was actually a promise. "Today I won't yell. I won't cry. I won't clench up into a ball like I am waiting for a blow to level me. I will enjoy today." She might make it to lunch before she went sour. They were all set now. Everyone washed, a quick prayer, and all was fine until Michelle spouted up. Ben needs to take off his hat. The Day family had always had a no-hat rule at the table. It was such a non-negotiable regulation that Patty was surprised to even have to address it. Ben does need to take off his hat, Patty said, her voice a gentle prod. Ben tilted his head toward her, and she felt a pinch of worry. Something was wrong. His eyebrows, normally thin, rusty lines, were black. The skin beneath stained a dark purple. Ben? He took off his hat, and on his head was a jet-black crown of hair, ruffed like an old Labrador. It was such a shock, like swallowing ice water too quickly. Her red-headed boy, Ben's defining characteristic, gone. He looked older, mean, as if this kid in front of her had bullied the Ben she knew into oblivion. Michelle screamed. Debbie burst into tears. Ben, sweetheart, why? Patty said. She was telling herself not to overreact, but that was just what she was doing. This stupid teenage act. That's all it was. Made her entire relationship with her son feel suddenly hopeless. As Ben stared down at the table, smirking, force-fielding himself from their female commotion, Patty worked up an excuse for him. He'd hated his red hair as a kid, been teased for it. Maybe he still was. Maybe this was an act of assertion, a positive thing. Then again, it was Patty who'd given Ben her red hair, which he'd just obliterated. How was that not a rejection? Libby, her only other redhead, clearly thought so. She sat holding a piece of her hair between two skinny fingers, staring at it morosely. All right, Ben said, slurping an egg and standing up. Enough drama. It's just stupid hair. Your hair was so handsome, though. He paused at that, as if he was really considering it, then shook his head at her comment, at the whole morning. She didn't know, and stomped toward the door. Just calm down, he called without turning around. I'll be back later. She was guessing he'd slam the door, but instead he shut it quietly, and that seemed worse. Patty blew at her bangs and glanced around the table at all the wide blue eyes, watching her to see how to react. She smiled and gave a weak laugh. Well, that was weird, she offered. The girls perked up a bit, visibly sitting higher in their chairs. He's so weird, Michelle added. His hair matches his clothes now, Debbie said, wiping her tears on the back of her hand and forking some pancake into her mouth. Libby just looked at her plate, shoulders caved in toward the table. It was a look of dejection only a kid could pull off. It's okay, Lib, Patty said, and tried to pat her casually without getting the other girls going again. No, it's not, she said. He hates us.
Libby Day. Now. 5 nights after my beer with Lyle, I drove down the bluff from my house, and then down some more into the trough of Kansas City's West Bottoms. The neighborhood had thrived back in the stockyard era, and then spent many decades the opposite of thriving. Now it was all tall, quiet brick buildings, bearing names of companies that no longer existed. Rafferty Cold Storage, London Beef, Danheiser Cattle Trust. A few reclaimed structures had been converted into professional haunted houses that lit up for Halloween season. 5-story slides and vampire castles and drunk teenagers hiding beers inside letter jackets. In early March, the place was just lonesome. As I drove through the still streets, I'd occasionally spot someone entering or leaving a building, but I had no idea what for. Near the Missouri River, The area turned from semi-empty to ominously vacant, an upright ruin. I felt a bulb of unease as I parked in front of a four-story building labeled Tallman Corporation. This was one of those moments where I wished I had more friends.